the next two questions have to do get into actually our Bible study here today, so that's why I think I'll take them at this time. Several places talk about worshiping on high places in a positive light. In 1 Chronicles 16 and verses 39 and 40, the priest Zadok offered at the high place at Gibeon, and which is true, he did. Ralph Levy, a few weeks ago, was one of the two speakers who gave the seminars up at St. Petersburg, and which some of you here, as well as from Miami, were up there. I'm trying to get turned over here real quickly to 1 Chronicles 16 before I read the next sentence. Let me look and see here. Verse 39 and 40. And Zadok the priest and his brethren the priests before the tabernacle of the Lord at the high place that was at Gibeon to offer burnt offerings to the Lord on the altar of burnt offering regularly morning and evening, and to do according to all that is written in the law of the Lord which he commanded Israel. So he was conducting the evening and morning sacrifice. He's a high priest. As we're going to see here, there were two at that time. The other one's Abiathar. And there are two tabernacles during the time of David. You have the one that is at Gibeon. You have another one that David had built in Jerusalem to bring the ark up to. All right, let me go on now. Dr. Levy mentioned that the pagans worshipped on the high places. Excuse me. To be closer to their gods. That's correct. My question is, were the high places good and or bad? Well, it depends. I went to Expositor's commentary, Bible commentary. I like it because it's fairly conservative, but especially on history and things like this, they seem to do a pretty good job of putting the whole thing together. So let me just read what I copied out. The high places were a constant sore point in Israel, and the prophets of God frequently spoke out against them. Israel was specifically forbidden to utilize pagan high places and altars. And that's, then they have in parentheses. Let's take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12, and this will probably raise an even bigger question about Zadok at Gibeon. In Deuteronomy 12, verse 2 through 4, you shall utterly destroy, well, I'll start in verse 1. These are the statutes, the judgments, which the Lord, which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you have shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. And goes on there explaining even more about that. All right, that's what they were to do. Now, by the time of David, they've been in the promised land how long? Oh, at least 300 years or more since they crossed the Jordan River. Okay, let me read on. The reason for the common use of various high places for worship at that time was that the temple had not yet been built. Before Eli's time, who was before Samuel, the tabernacle had been at Shiloh. But with the Philistines' capture of the ark at Shiloh, Shiloh lost its significance as the place of God's presence among his people. Even after the ark was returned by the Philistines, it remained for years in the house of Abinadab, and you'll find that in 1 Samuel chapter 7 and in verse 1. You know, that got to be a hot item for them to have, and every time they had that ark near Dagon, Dagon fell over overnight, and then they had problems having children. They attributed it all to the fact to the Israelites' God, which in this box, as they looked at it. So, by the way, the number of years that they brought it back, and it was put in the home of Abinadab, 1 Samuel 7:1. And when you turn there, you'll see that it was there for 20 years. 20 years, the ark was there. Now, where was the tabernacle? The tabernacle wasn't at Shiloh anymore. But, and neither was the ark, But the ark had been returned to Israel in this man's home. And until David removed it to Jerusalem, 2 Samuel 6, remember when Uzzah died? Because he touched it as they were bringing it up from Abinadab's home. To a tent or tabernacle that he had prepared for it there, verse 17 of 2 Samuel 6. In the meantime, the tabernacle was removed from Shiloh after the capture of the ark. Now, what you have here is the original tabernacle is over here, and the ark's over here. They're not together, are they? And they're not going to be either until the temple is constructed by Solomon, which I didn't realize. I didn't notice that, but I'll give you a scripture showing that in a moment. The ark next appears at Nob, N-O-B, in 1 Samuel 21. David's on the run from Saul. He comes over. Remember, he ate the showbread there. Ahimelech was the high priest at the time. He lets him. He's an elderly man. And it was there where it remained until Saul massacred the priests in the next chapter, 22. And remember, the Israelite soldiers refused to kill the priests that Saul commanded them. So this Edomite named Doeg, D-O-E-G, D-O-E-G, he killed them, about 85, I think it was, except for one who escaped, Abiathar, son of Ahimelech, the high priest. Abiathar becomes high priest in Jerusalem. Zadok is high priest at Gibeon. Now, let me pick up here where I find my place again and go on. Then at some point after this, after the massacre, it was moved to Gibeon, where it is mentioned in connection with Zadok's high priestly ministry, there in 1 Chronicles 16. Gibeon continued to exist as Israel's primary sanctuary for sacrifice, as verse 40 here shows, until Solomon's construction of the Jerusalem temple. It's interesting in 2 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 13... 2 Chronicles, chapter 1 and in verse 13. So Solomon came to Jerusalem from the high place that was at Gibeon from before the tabernacle of meeting and reigned over Israel. And of course, he will bring the, when the temple is to be dedicated here, the Ark of the Covenant, chapter 4 of the, well, chapter 4 of the second of 1 Kings, he will bring it in to the new temple. Let me finish this. There were then, in effect, two tabernacles during David's reign. The one in Gibeon was without the ark, and that was the original. The one in Jerusalem had the ark, but not the original trappings of the tabernacle that came out of the wilderness. This state of affairs matched that of the double priesthood of Zadok and Abiathar. Zadok, by the way, is the one mentioned in the in Ezekiel. What is it? I forgot the chapter, but it's between 40 and 48 when it talks about in the millennium. Descendants of Zadok will do what? They will be the attendants at the new temple that is built in Jerusalem after Christ returns. Now, I guess only God would know who they would be today. maybe some of the Jewish people, they know who the Kohens are if they should ever get back to... I don't know if they're going to build a temple or just an altar or what they're going to do. We'll have to wait and see. But there will be animal morning and evening and morning sacrifices before Christ returns that will then be cut off. So, let's see. Yeah, I read that. Oh, one other note that they brought out here concerning the high places. Notice that Samuel brought offerings at various high places. 1 Samuel 9, verse 11 through 25. These sacrifices were apparently supplementary to the official services connected with the tabernacle, because the tabernacle wasn't at the location where he had of these high places. This practice was legitimate at this time as long as the high places had no associations whatsoever with Canaanite religions. After the building of the temple, the high places were no longer legitimate. And although they went back to them after the death of Solomon, they may have even done it. I can't have to go back and see whether in Solomon's time and 40 years, whether he allowed it to come back or to use it again or not. But you'll recall that many of the kings who, like Hezekiah and Josiah, they got rid of them once they understood that they were wrong and all of that. And others did too, I think, Jehoshaphat. But, so, did I answer the question here? Why? Well, because it was permissible, apparently, to do that at that time, and there was nothing that God indicated that it was a sin. When you talk about a high place, you know, it's how high are we talking? It's not like mountains here, and it would have been more of a rise there in Gibeon to do it. But that's where they had it. And by the way, what was Mount Moriah? Wasn't it a high, kind of a high place? Well, it was the highest place in Jerusalem, right? Now, sure, the Mount of Olives, but it's across the Kidron Valley from the city of Jerusalem. It is a little higher. But, in case you can't tell that Mount Moriah was ever a mount because of the way everything looks today. But before the platform was there and all of that, you know, it was like any others around it. And it was the highest location. David, remember, the stronghold of Zion was down the hill of Gihon from where Ornan the Jebusite's threshing floor was, which was on the top of Mount Moriah. And that at the end of the Bible study is what David today will purchase for the future temple. Question, the last question. 1 Chronicles 21, why was it a sin for David to count the people at this time? He numbers the people at their time, at other times, as in 1 Chronicles 23 and verse 27, where it says that the last words of David were when he numbered the Levites. And he did. Nothing wrong with what he did there, numbering the Levites. This, actually, 2 Samuel 24, the last chapter of 2 Samuel covers this. And also, of course, 1 Chronicles 21. You need to have your hand on both of these and kind of flip back here for a moment from one to the other. And because there is just a little different wording in one as opposed to the other. But there's nevertheless a question about this, because it was not wrong to take a census. In Numbers chapter 1, verse 1 and 2, God commanded Moses to take a census of the Israelites in the second year out of Egypt. Numbers 1, verse 1 and 2. And it says there that everyone from age 20 and up, you count. But if you go then to chapter 3 of Numbers in verse 15, it's different for the Levites. There you count every male who is 1 month old and up. And of course, they didn't have an inheritance. That may have something to do with it. But that was the exception. Otherwise, you were to count from 20 years and up. Now, that's what David was doing. Moses was commanded to do it, no sin. So what else is going on here? Is the taking of another thing to bring into this? Well, first of all, let me read the 2 Samuel 24:1 and 1 Chronicles 21:1 and compare the two accounts. In 24:1, again, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. Now, the word again does not appear if you flip over here to 1 Chronicles 21 and verse 1. Now, Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. Now, you probably can see a situation here, because 24:1 says the Lord did. And here in 21:1, Satan did. So who did it? Now, when you run into something like this in the Bible, you put the scriptures together. You don't subtract them apart and try to say, aha, see, contradiction. And that's what some people will do, but that is a mistake. And here in the expositors, did a very good job of explaining that, and I'll read that in just a moment here to you. But let me, a couple other things I want to cover before I do answer that. Back here to 2 Samuel 24:1, the word again, now as you just saw it, again does not appear in 1 Chronicles, but it does in 2 Samuel. That means this is not the first time. Otherwise it wouldn't be again. So something here has happened. It says again the anger of the Lord was aroused. So his anger was aroused before. Well, the only other time that we have anything in Scripture of when was the previous time is chapter 21, if you go back, second, which we will oh, let's see here, where did I put it? In, yes, 2 Samuel 21. This also we will be covering today, but I can hit it right at this moment. 2 Samuel 21, 1. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, it is because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites. Now, this is nowhere mentioned in 1 Samuel when Saul was king, that he slaughtered these people who were not Israelites, but they happened to be. It goes back to Joshua coming into the promised land. These people, they did not want to, like all the others, take on the Israelites. They wanted to coexist in peace. So they made a treaty with Joshua. It was honored for over 300 years until the time of Saul. And because the Gibeonites lived on the area of the territory that was given to the tribe of Benjamin, and he was a Benjaminite, according to this, he slaughtered many of them and killed many of them. Now, by the time we get here to this chapter, it's probably 25, 30 years after this happened. Yeah, there's no record in Scripture of it happening before we come to chapter 21. But God's anger is still there over this, and he wants this taken care of. And we'll get to it later. He does have it taken care of. But anyhow, coming back now to 24 and verse 1 again. When it says, again, the anger, the only thing that would indicate was the situation that when God, after 3 years of giving them famine, that they finally, David was revealed to David, why the famine? Because of what Saul did to those people. And there has to be restitution for that. So now we come to, what's the problem here? Is it just taking the census, or is there something else involved in this? Well, let me read a couple things here. Again, I'm going to use the expositor's commentary. Just as the Lord's anger had burned against Uzzah because of an irreverent act on his part in 2 Samuel 6 and verse 7 by touching, reaching out to on the ark, so also the anger of the Lord burned against Israel in this case because of an unspecified sin. That it did so, quote, again, verse 1 of chapter 24, would appear to reflect back on the three-year famine in chapter 21, verse 1, which we just read. Thus the Lord, through Satan, this is an explanation of the two verses, 24:1, 21:1. Thus the Lord, through Satan, incited David against Israel by moving him to take a census of Israel and Judah. Since census-taking was not sinful in and of itself, what was the nature of David's transgression that he's mad about here, that God is angry about, over this situation? Now, thinking a little bit more about it, it's hard really to say for sure because, actually, I learned a little something after going through the Bible study here this morning in Miami. It crossed my mind as we're coming on our way back here. If you look at chapter 24, 2 Samuel 24, verse 2, so the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, now go throughout all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and count the people that I may know the number of the people. Verse 3, and Joab said to the king, now may the Lord your God add to the people 100-fold more than there are, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why does my lord the king desire this thing? Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. So they disagreed. And now Joab is not a spiritual man, as you're going to see today. He's a cold-blooded killer. So what is it that Job sees here, Joab sees that he is in disagreement? And I'm not sure what it is for sure. And it just simply, I think the best way to put it, it's an unspecified sin. Now there is a couple speculations that may play into this in some way. Because notice Joab said to him, where did he say? verse 3, now may the Lord your God add to the people 100-fold more than there are, and may the eyes of the Lord the king see it. So was he in question as to whether the Lord was adding to Israel or not? Because in 1 Chronicles 27, there is this little scripture, 1 Chronicles 27. And that chapter is talking about all of the military divisions that he had, the leaders of the tribes. But if you look at verse 23 and 24, but David did not take the number of those 20 years old and under at the time, because the Lord had said that he would multiply Israel like the stars of the heavens. Is this what Joab was referring to? No, this is a promise given more than once to the patriarchs in the book of Genesis, that they would be multiplied like the stars of heaven. Now, Joab said to him over here, going back, and may the eyes of my Lord, the king, see it. Does he not see it? Is that what he is saying? That is this why he's doing it? Because I don't see that God is fulfilling his promise. That's one of the speculations of, was it a lack of faith at this time that God had not fulfilled or had not at this point fulfilled his promise to make Israel, as this, as it says here, to the fulfill the promise that he would multiply Israel like the stars of the heavens. The next verse, 24, Joab the son of Zeruiah began a census, but he did not finish. Doesn't say that, does it, in going back to chapter 24 or even in 1 Chronicles 21. Doesn't say he finished. You would assume he did, but he didn't. Here's the only place that I know of where it says that. For wrath came upon Israel because of this census. Nor was the number recorded in the account of the Chronicles of King David. But it seems to imply here, because the reason for the wrath appears to be over verse 23, that seems to be a good possibility here. Why did David insist upon this? Why did Joab say, "I hope that my lord the king may see that God is going to do this"? Again, that's just kind of trying to make an educated guess, I guess. But why is this verse 23 here, that in which it says, because the Lord had said that he would multiply Israel like the stars of the heavens? What has that got to do with this census that David took? It's not the census of itself. It doesn't appear to be wrong, because, as we've already seen, God even commanded Moses to take a census. And you mentioned the Levites. Yes, that's right. He took a census of the Levites. Nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's how we got the order of the priests to serve in the temple. Otherwise, you had mass confusion. They had to be because of they had populated so much. So boiling this down, it appears in this case that David's sin was not trusting God to keep his promise to multiply Israel as the stars of heaven. That's what it appears possibly to have been, may or may not. Again, I can't say dogmatically that David may not have looked to God. Now, there is one other thing that comes into this, and I'll take a moment to... Let's go back here to Exodus chapter 30. Exodus, the 30th chapter. If you're going to take a census, and we have no record in reading about that particular census that David took, that this was carried out. But here in Exodus 30 and verse 11, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, when you take the census of the children of Israel for their number, then every man shall give a ransom for himself to the Lord. And when you number them, that there may be no plague among them when you number them. And this, of course, so apparently this didn't happen either that at that time. This is what everyone among those who are numbered shall give, a half shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary. A shekel is 20 gerahs, and the half shekel shall be an offering to the Lord. Everyone included among those who are numbered from 20 years old and above shall give an offering to the Lord. Now, that's what David was doing. He was insisting that Joab number those 20 and above, but there's nothing about the paying of the half shekel. The rich shall not give more than the poor and the poor shall not give less than half a shekel when you give an offering to the Lord to make atonement for yourselves. And you shall take the atonement money of the children of Israel and shall appoint it for the service of the tabernacle of meeting, that it may be a memorial for the children of Israel before the Lord to make atonement for yourselves. And so this was the instruction, and this is what was to be done if you take and you have a census. But we read nothing about that being done in the one that David took. So that may be also another factor to consider in this. But before it even began, before they even began to count, Joab is arguing, if you will, with the king, that what are we doing this for? And making that statement to the king that, what is the statement, verse 3, now may the Lord your God add to the people 100-fold more than there are, and may the eyes of the Lord the king see it. Because you don't, I'm assuming, because he doesn't see it. So, anyhow, I hope that sheds some light on it. I don't know that, like I say, that's the best we can come up with, because as I think it's well worded here, because it is an unspecified sin. It is not specified like others are that we run into in the Bible. Okay, let's go on and get to chapter 19, and we will finish the book of Samuel, but the Bible study will not end there. Because we have to go into 1 Kings. That's when David dies. All right, but we were going to make some fast tracks here today because I want to finish. I do want to take a little time here and a couple things in the first few chapters that we're going to cover. Chapter 19, this is after the death of Absalom, which took place last Bible study. And it's interesting, you see a little bit about human nature of this Joab, who is related distantly to King David. He is a very strong individual. He has a very strong brother, Abishai. David many times makes the statement, what am I going to do with you sons of Zeruiah? Because they were really at times a problem to him, but they had too much power, and so he couldn't do a lot. But in chapter 18 is where the battle took place. When David had to flee, he left Jerusalem, went down, crossed the Jordan at Jericho, went up to Mahanaim. A guy named Barzillai, an 80-year-old man, provided many provisions for him when he was on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and a lot of people came to David's aid. He also had the best of the commanders of the military, Joab and Abishai. And Ittai, I-T-T-A-I, I think, those three were pretty good commanders in which forces could be divided in order to defend themselves or even attack. Absalom, chasing after his father to kill him, came with a superior force. But when they met in superior force in numbers, but not in skill, Joab and Abishai basically took Israel's army apart, even though they were greatly outnumbered in the battle here in chapter 18. Now, what happened was that most of the Israelites who lost their lives, of the 20,000 who died that day, was not by the sword, as it says here, but by the thickets that they apparently were either they were pushed into and retreat or something. I don't know what kind of thickets this would be, but many of them died running through these thickets or going through on horseback or whatever they did, and I guess it just tore them apart. Now, Absalom going through there got caught up with his hair. Most people don't realize he was injured. And, so what if he got his hair? Well, why don't you climb out there and get yourself, because he's injured. And let me just a couple scriptures here before we start in chapter 19, because it's important in what happens in the first few verses in chapter 19 to have a review. In chapter 18, verse 5, now the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, his three generals, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. Now all the people are of the tribe of Judah. That is, of course, behind David and supporting him. All right, so everybody understands. I want him alive. Don't kill him. So this Cushite individual, verse 12, comes and reports, but the man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. So this young soldier here, who is reporting, look, there he is. I know where he is. But he wouldn't kill him or do anything like that, but not Joab. Now you look at verse 14. Then Joab said, I cannot linger with you. And he took 3 spears in his hand, and he thrust him through Absalom's heart while he was still alive. In the midst, if he's still alive, means he's near death, right? And so he ran him through with the spears and all of that. Okay, with that in mind, here you have a general. He had killed, remember he killed Abner, who was Saul's commander-in-chief of his army. And then, which David was welcoming Abner, who was coming over to David's side. But Joab was a person who, if he considered anybody to be a threat, he would stick a dagger in him. Now, Absalom was a threat to him. See, Joab was the kind of person, he could not become king because David was too popular and supported too much by the people. But he could ride on David's coattail, so to speak, to success in his own life and become as he did. Now, so he gets rid of Absalom here. David, what are you going to do about it? You can't do anything about it. In other words, he knows he's got a certain amount of leverage here. But it shows you the mind of this guy. He's a killer. He's a great general in the battles and being able to move his troops and be able to get the most, and especially when they're outnumbered. He was very good at those things. But his character was not very good. Now let's, verse 1, chapter 19, and Joab was told, behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it and said that day, the king is grieved for his son. And the people stole back into the city that day, and as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. Well, they had been beaten. But the king covered his face. And the king cried out with a loud voice, O my son, Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends, for you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants, for today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well. I haven't done any. I have saved your life, you ungrateful king. See the human nature of the transferring the blame? You ever seen that before? No, I did nothing wrong. He's covering his tracks. He deliberately killed the king's son when he was given orders in front of everybody not to do that. So instead, he's just flipping this thing upside down or around. It's not me. Why? What? You've disgraced the whole nation by the way you're acting over this. Now, David knew the heart of this man, and he was in no position or had no power to have him arrested or anything else. In one sense, David's hands were tied because Joab, along with his brother Abishai, did have power. And like I say, it was kind of like they needed each other. In one sense, David needed them in the battles that he had to fight. But if he could have possibly gotten rid of Joab, because he did not care for Joab at all. Well, verse going on. Now, therefore, arise, go out and speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, as though he is a religious man, he's not. If you do not go out, not one will stay with you this night, and that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. Now, I know everything you've done. I've kept tabs on everything. And in other words, he's giving him a threat here. And but it's the interesting thing here is when you see how that's nothing new, just circumstances. But you've probably seen this in your lifetime. I see this in politics. I turn it on the 6 o'clock news and I see this. It's called spin. it is incredible when you listen to how some of these people come on these talk news shows to spin their side and turn it all the way around, upside down. They are as guilty can be, and yet they've got this lie figured out how to turn around, and they come across just like Joab, just so convincing, so impassioned, and many people are fooled. The Israelites were fooled by Joab. He was convincing to them, many of them, and that's how he thought he was going to be able to cover his tracks and save his hide. And yes.
Why didn't God step in?
Well, because, I don't know, God doesn't say why he didn't step in. you can carry that back several steps. Why didn't he step in to stop Absalom before we even got to this point? God, in one sense, does step in, and he did here because, when we get to chapter 22, you're going to see how David talks about how God did step in. So hang on to that, and I'll mention that when we get up to chapter 22. Now, let me go forward. Okay, then in verse 9, now all the people were in a dispute throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying that the king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom he anointed over us, has died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king? So he's kind of in limbo right now. Absalom is dead. I don't know exactly if it even says here how much time is going by. They have not crossed over the Jordan to come back into Israel. Finally, he summons Zadok and Abiathar, the two priests, in verse 11. Go to the tribe of Judah, which was his tribe, and tell them, why aren't you bringing me back? I mean, you were there. I mean, you're the last to speak. Everybody else is mumbling and talking about this, especially of the other tribes of Israel and those who were defeated in the battle. Well, anyhow, finally they do bring David back to become the king at Jerusalem. The rest of the chapter, let me kind of, instead of reading all the verses, mention a few things. In verses 18 through 23, you have, verse 18, then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good and so forth. That's across the Jordan River. Most likely it's there at Jericho. Then Shimei. You remember Shimei from the previous Bible study? He was a Benjaminite. He's the one that cursed the king and threw rocks at him as he was fleeing Absalom, going out of town. Abishai, even at that time, wanted to run the spear through him for his total disrespect of King David and of the office and everything else. He followed him for quite some distance, throwing these rocks and cursing at him and everything, and calling him a bloody man because he was of the house of Saul. But David didn't do anything to Saul. See, Abishai was Shimei. He was a person in one sense like Joab, corrupt in the head, blaming David for the downfall of Saul. He had nothing to do with Saul. He kept trying to stay away from Saul. You all know that. And yet his curses were all about David being this bloody man, as though and implying that he was responsible for the death and so forth of Saul. Now, surely amendments should have been taken here that this man should be executed. In fact, Abishai, in these verses I just mentioned, in verse 21, wants to execute Shimei. And guess what? David throws quite a curve. He said, no. Verse 23, therefore the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king swore to him. Now, later, before he dies, that is, David dies, he instructs his son Solomon not to let Shimei go to his grave in peace, and the same for Joab. But he was not going to do it at this time, although he had every right to do it, but he didn't. Now, verse 24 through 30 is an interesting story and for us to think about. Remember, Mephibosheth is the son of Jonathan. And back in chapter, what chapter was it? I forgot now, but 14, somewhere back there. He had asked his servants, is there anybody left of the house of Saul who I can, what was he saying, bless or do whatever? And they said, yes, there's one, a son of Jonathan. So he summoned this Mephibosheth, who was lame in both feet because of an accident when his nurse was carrying him to get away from the Philistines at the battle that resulted in his father's death. So what he said to the guy was, look, this servant of Saul's named Ziba, who has, I forgot the number of sons, and Ziba talked to David about Mephibosheth. So what David said, to try to do things right, and because of his oath and so forth with Jonathan as well, I'm going to give you all of Saul's land that he had, that he owned as king. And Ziba and his servants, they're going to take care of it for you because you're lame. And you're going to eat at the king's table for the rest of your life. That's quite that's benevolent on the part of David to do. He didn't have to do anything. Well, in chapter 16, when David has to flee from Absalom, guess who comes first, one of the first to come, is his servant Ziba. Chapter 16 here, and in verse 1 through 4, here comes Ziba to David. He brings the donkeys, the skins of wine, the clusters and so forth of raisins, and all these things, provisions. And the king said to Ziba, what do you mean to do with these? And Ziba said, well, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine of those for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink. The king said, and where is your master's son, meaning Mephibosheth? And Ziba said to the king, indeed, he is staying in Jerusalem. In other words, he's going to stay with Absalom. For he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. And so the king said to Ziba, here all that belongs to Mephibosheth is now yours. And Ziba said, I humbly bow before you that I may find favor in your sight, my lord, O king. Okay, so now the land that he'd given to Mephibosheth, he says, even though David's leaving town, it's going to be yours, Ziba. Appreciate what Ziba did. All right, now we get a different story here. This is interesting. So see if you guys, all of you people can figure out who's telling the truth. To tell the truth, right? Okay. So now Mephibosheth, verse 24, the son of Saul came down to meet the king here in chapter 19. And he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day that the king departed until the day he came back in peace. Probably had a pretty good growth. So it was that when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? He answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go to the king because your servant is lame. And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king, yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I to cry out any more to the king? And so the king said to him, why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, you and Ziba divide the land. Wait a minute. He had given that to Ziba because Ziba had given him provisions when he left town. Who's telling the truth? Who's telling the truth? Was Ziba telling the truth? How do you know? Now this, but one other thing comes into play here. Why would Ziba, when he knows that Absalom's now in charge and coming to take over Jerusalem, and David is fleeing for his life, what does he have to gain by bringing all those provisions and everything to David?
Insurance.
From what? He's in good with Absalom. He stayed behind. He gave David these provisions, right? But he didn't go with David. Or did he go with David? I don't think he says he went with David. But Mephibosheth, who he was supposed to be the servant to, he said to David, he's going to stay in Jerusalem. And why is he going to stay in Jerusalem? Because he believes now that it's going to be restored to me. Was he telling David the truth about Mephibosheth, or was he slandering Mephibosheth? Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think David does not know and probably is suspecting that both are lying. So what does he do? He doesn't know what the answer is. So he says, the two of you get to divide the land. Originally, it was Mephibosheth's land. Ziba worked it. When he had to flee and Ziba brought all the provisions, he said, now the land is yours. He listened to the story and he believed the story at that time, that Mephibosheth was going to stay in Jerusalem with Absalom. Now he hears this story. You know, it's kind of like Solomon later. Two women come. I think they were both prostitutes, weren't they? And they had a baby. The one had a baby, but the other one wanted that baby. And they both claimed it was theirs. So they said, well, okay, we can solve that problem. Just, I don't know which one's telling the truth. We'll cut it in half, and you each get a half. And, of course, the real mother said no. She'd give it up before she would see her little son or baby killed. So Solomon said, all right, this is the mother. You know what's interesting even about that story is it doesn't, if you go look at it, it doesn't tell us what Solomon did to the one who was lying. It doesn't say anything at all. The one that was lying was willing to have the child killed. I don't know. The Bible doesn't say. Okay, let's move along here so I can finish up before 7 o'clock here at least. So, okay. Very interesting, though, how David handled this. It appears to me, anyhow, I'll say that David did not know for sure who was telling the truth. Because he had given it to Ziba when he left. Then he, instead of saying to Mephibosheth, well, I've given the land to Ziba. No, you and Ziba divide it. Why would he say that? Because I'm not sure who's telling the truth. They may have both been partially correct and partially wrong. A lot of times when people tell lies, they tell the truth to win your confidence before telling the lie or sliding off into the lie that would lead you to believe something other than what it really is. That's how Satan the devil works. How does he deceive people? He doesn't deceive people by just coming right up to him and telling them a lie. You have to gain their confidence, and you do that by what? Telling them the truth. And once you have their confidence, then you begin to slide the lie in, a little here and a little there. All right, let's quickly go along here. Verse 31 through 39 is interesting because here's Barzillai, an 80-year-old man who took care of David. And David wants to bring him up to Jerusalem and really provide for him in a way that maybe he has never been all of his life, but he turns him down, he thanks him very much, and he wants to stay in his village of Mahanaim, which he opened up to David and his troops when they were on the run. David took care of those people who did these things for him. He did not forget about rewarding them and showing kindness to them because of that. David's very interesting, a man after God's own heart. He rewarded those who helped him, and those who did terrible things against him, you would have thought he would have carried out justice, but he didn't. And he did show mercy, and he knew that Shimei, for example, this was just a big act and he wasn't sincere. He wasn't fooling David. Neither was Joab fooling David either. He knew him, quite well. Well, going on, let's go to chapter 20. We have a rebellion. We have a guy named, it says here Sheba, but it's, I think other places it's S-H-I, Sheba, I believe is what it really is. It calls him here a rebel in verse 1, which means a man of Belial. He's a here we go again, Benjaminites. They really hate the fact that this Jew, David, has taken the place of Saul. And and apparently the Benjaminites, or a lot of them anyhow, wanted to be in the top position in government. So he says, look, rise, we're going to overthrow David. Absalom's dead, but we can't let David be king. And so this is quite a threat. So David tells Amasa, A-M-A-S-A, and I believe Amasa is his own nephew, from his brother. Amasa was the commander-in-chief under Absalom. Now, here in chapter 20, let me put my, where did I see it? Back up here, where did I miss it? Oh, no, back, excuse me, one verse over here. In chapter 19, in talking with Amasa at the time David is being brought back by the people to be the king, once again. Verse 13, and say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God, do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab. Well, he meant well, but that signed Amasa's death warrant right there by saying that, because Joab said, nobody replaces me. I'm reading between the lines. And so then now turn over to page chapter 20 again with that in mind. So this Sheba goes out to get an army and try to overthrow David. David realizes this is a formidable threat. He tells Amasa. verse 5, so Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him to do this. He was late getting to getting the job done. So David then had Abishai and Joab and so forth. We're going to have to act here. He sends them out after this guy, Sheba. Well, Joab runs into Amasa, verse 9, and he says, are you in health, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. You know, like we would go up and give people a hug today. This was what it was, you know. And so Amasa's guard was let down when Joab came to him in that way. But Amasa, verse 10, did not notice. He had a sword, actually had a dagger, that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground, and he did not strike him again. Thus he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri, until they got to the village where a woman in the village took care of that guy, and that ended that. But it shows the mind of this guy, Joab. He has killed Abner, now Amasa, who was David's nephew. David had made him commander-in-chief and over Joab. Joab is also related to David as well. And of course, so his brother Abishai would be as well. But to kill people, to have no conscience about this whatsoever, and he got his opportunity because he was away from Jerusalem, and David, just like he killed Abner, he looked for the opportunity, and he would do it. Going to call the police? I'm the police. What's the king going to do about it? He can't do anything. Because I am the commander. I'm the commander of the army. So David, that's why he made that expression a number of times. What will I do with you sons of Zeruiah? Because they were such what's the word to use? Caused a great deal of stress to David because of their lack of any real good character. Great commanders, but bad character. Chapter 21, David avenges the Gibeonites. We've covered in answering the questions already, and that's I'll just mention here, verse 2, so the king called the Gibeonites after this became, God made it known to David. He spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. The children of Israel had sworn protection to them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah, when he was, of course, king. Therefore David said to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you, and with what shall I make atonement, that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And the Gibeonites said to him, we will have no silver or gold from Saul or from his house, nor shall you kill any man in Israel for us. And he said, well, whatsoever you say, that will I do for you. So they answered the king, as for the man who consumed us and plotted against us, that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the territories of Israel, let 7 men of his descendants be delivered to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord chose. And the king said, I will give them. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. So the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, who is a different one, the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul, and the 5 sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Mahalatite. If I can say that little, get my tongue here moving. Now, what's interesting about these 7, this Michal, of course, was David's first wife. Now, you may, how could she have had 5 sons? This Adriel is not mentioned because, you know, later Saul gave her, after David's on the run, he takes Michal and gives him to, what was the guy's name, Peltai or something like that. And he becomes the husband of Michal. And I looked this up in the commentaries. Yeah, there's Michal, the daughter of Saul. There's no one else. There's no 2 Michals. He didn't have 2 daughters with the same name. Well, if you recall, what was the age difference between Jonathan and David? Almost 30 years. When you go back there to look at the David, Jonathan is leading an army against the Philistines after Saul becomes the king, when David hasn't even been born yet. Quite a relationship that they had, and a respect that Jonathan had to this younger man, David. Now, if we know that the difference in age between those two, what it was, well, then that might explain about Michal. Because you probably assume that when the king gives his daughter to David shortly after killing Goliath, that they're probably the same age, right? Doesn't say that, does it? In fact, we don't know what her age is. But if we know how old that Saul is, and we see the listings of his children, he had 4 sons and whatever daughters, and Michal, was she in the order of the birthright order? Where was she? Jonathan was the firstborn son. Was Michal, or however you say it, where was she in the order? Was she there before the next son, or what? In other words, she could have been married at age 18 to 20 and had 5 sons before, and something had happened to Adriel, the husband who fathered those sons, either sickness and disease and died, or killed in battle or something. We don't know. The Bible doesn't say. Before she may have been a widow. I don't know. When she was given to David to be his wife. Really, there's not enough information to really explain. All you can do is conjecture. Anyhow, we'll move on because we don't need to worry about the answer on that much. It's just one of those trivial pursuit things to look at. Chapter 21, of course, we just covered that. Chapter 22 is, well, wait, before I finish 21, there's something important here to point out. Verse 15 to the end of the chapter talks about the final battles with the Philistines that David participated in. When the Philistines, verse 15, were at war again with Israel, David and his servants with him went down and fought against the Philistines, and David grew faint. Note that. He grew faint in the battle. Abishai Benab, who was one of the sons of the giants, the weight of whose bronze spear was 300 shekels, who was bearing a new sword, thought that he could kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and struck the Philistine, and he killed him. This Philistine otherwise would have killed David. At this period of time, David is about 64 years old. We know that he dies at age 70. His temperature is dropping. He is weak. He is sick. He can't even get out of bed. He cannot really carry on the functions of the king anymore. We'll be getting to that in just a moment. The reason I mention this is because David grew faint. Whatever he had, was it beginning at this time? And he didn't really realize it. He's obviously over the hill for going out and fighting giants. And, you know, he's had quite a life. But Abishai was able to come, and to his nephew came and saved his life from the giant. It wasn't like when he fought Goliath. And this was a little bit different. And then as you see there, they said to him, "Then the men of David swore to him, saying, 'You shall go out no more with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel.'" In other words, you came close to dying. We need you as king. And if you die, that quenches the lamp of Israel, is what they were saying. And you're going to stay back. We'll do the fighting. Chapter 22 is Psalm 18. And it's interesting about Psalm 18. Why is it here? It does fit very well, because this properly follows David's life being saved by Abishai and the Philistine giants finally being killed off, as you read the rest of chapter 21. A few interesting verses. You asked me, George, the question here about why didn't God intercede? Well, look at David's answer in this psalm, starting in verse 2. "The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer, the God of my strength. In him I will trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my Savior. You saved me from violence. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies." This is how David looked at it. In other words, that the Lord did intercede, or otherwise he would have never got to this point. And he had quite a life. Now, some of the problems he was having here with Absalom, he brought on himself, didn't he? By the sins with Bathsheba and having her husband killed and all of that, one thing led to the other. And David, in some ways, I mean, God certainly delivered him, but he did, you wonder, did it take its toll? Barzillai, in the previous chapter, was 80 years old when he came to David. David would have been at that time probably somewhere between 62, 63 to 60, leading up to 64. So Barzillai was quite a bit older, wasn't he? Seemed to be in pretty good shape. Just talking there, I mean, reading what he said. But David's life, it appears, is catching up to him. And he's had a hard life in many ways. He's been at war an awful lot. He's gone through a tremendous stress, the loss of his son, one son raping his daughter, then one son killing that son, on and on. It's got to, you would think, take a toll on a person from the stress, the things that they're going through, because he knows in his mind, had he not done some of the things he did earlier there, the sins with Bathsheba and what followed afterwards, that a lot of this may never have happened. Because even Nathan said there in chapter 12 that, look, these things are going to come to you from in your own house. And they did. And there were relatives of Bathsheba who they had it in for David. And they didn't like that at all. David had a lot of enemies. And yet the Bible says he's a man after God's own heart. Now, his life was shorter, because you would have thought he would have lived a little bit longer. But you have to wonder here, and especially when he grows faint out here. what was it? I don't know. You doctors, can you help me out? What would cause it? Would it be congestive heart failure begin to set in or something causing the eventually temperature drop? I don't know. I'm just trying to, what is it that could possibly do it? Anybody have any guess? I'm looking over here at the wrong document.
Exhaustion.
The exhaustion, that was it, okay. Yeah, too many wives, there you go. Yeah, kind of like I am at times. No. Well, we can only guess around, but it makes you wonder when you read things like that, and you know that he's only going to live another 6 years. And, you know, that he's, by age 70, you know, his body is exhausted and giving out completely, very aged by that time. Okay, a couple other things here. This is a very good psalm to read. It's Psalm 18. It shows the mind of David. You sure wouldn't see words like this coming out of the mouth of Joab. Or Abishai or any of those others. But David, even though he did the things he did, God was very merciful. His life is, it's an amazing thing because it shows what mercy God has and the forgiveness he has. Look at this promise he gave to David. And Jesus will return to sit on whose throne? David's throne. And just incredible the things. And David will be resurrected to be king over Israel forever. And you read that in both Jeremiah 23, you read that again in Ezekiel 37. And a lot of the things written about David were, at least 200 years after his death, as far as the prophetic promises through the prophets. Yes, from him. That's hard to explain, though. I know what you're asking, because, well, then how can this be that she had five sons that are later executed? I don't know. But there's no evidence anywhere that there were, Saul had two daughters with the same name.
My Bible doesn't say Michal, it says M-E-R-A-B. That daughter, she was the one that was married to that guy, A-D-R-A-B.
Oh, Mary. Merab, that's also McCall's name. And back when you go back to where McCall is given to David, the center margin also says it's Merab, M-E-R-A-B.
Is that? She was married to that guy and had five sons.
Yeah.
That's
the same person.
Oh.
Yeah. If you go back to McCall, after he kills Goliath, not too long after that, he gives McCall, and the center margin says her name is Merab. In other words, it's like Mephibosheth is, Baal is what Mephibosheth means. And because in the account in First Chronicles, it's not Mephibosheth, it's something Baal. In other words, they have more than one name. Solomon had, remember what Solomon's name was? Started with the letter J. Jedediah, it's back there, and I want to go back and look it up. When he was born, David gave him not the name Solomon, but the name that meant the beloved of the Lord. But he was given later, he had two names. But there's only one scripture where you read of the name that he was called at birth. Camille, get on that and see if you can find that scripture back there where McCall, it's again center margin, and it should be Merab, M-E-R-A-B. And if I'm wrong, let's see, how many lashes? No? Okay, let me quickly go along here to finish up. Where are we? Okay, I'll let you read Psalm 18. It's really a very, very good psalm. Chapter 23, we're getting down to the last words of David in the first seven verses. He talks then, the rest of the chapter goes through his, quote, mighty men. Chapter 24, we've covered the senses. And the specific sin, it's hard to say because the Bible doesn't say. One thing I will call to your attention in chapter 24 is showing you the mind of David. In verse 10, he realizes in his heart, I have sinned by doing this. And he says, I have sinned greatly in what I have done, but now I pray, O Lord, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. Well, the prophet Gad comes to him, and he gives him three choices of punishment. And David, he doesn't take any of them. Verse 14, David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Please let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. That was his answer. In other words, I'm not going to take any one of those three choices, Gad. I'll put my life in God's hands for him to decide, and I'd rather be in God's hands than in the hands of man. So we see that David is a man of faith. And one of the outstanding things, I guess, if I was to summarize David's life, that we could all learn from David, that despite all the mistakes and sins he committed, this man never gave up. He always would come back to God. Other people will justify themselves, like Joab, or try to switch it around, you know, rather than facing up and admitting their sins and their guilt. But David, once, you know, it was brought to his attention, he would not justify himself. And he would not give up. And he would always come back to put his faith and trust in God. The remainder of chapter 24, Gad tells him to go up to Ornan the Jebusite, who has a threshing floor on Mount Moriah, and buy it from him. And there have an offering and make an offering up there, and that God would take away the plague. Verse 24, the king said to Ornan, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, because he was going to give it to him. Nor will I offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God with that which costs me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. Pretty good price that he gave for that. Because when you're bringing something before God, if it has no value and if it isn't worth anything, and David understood this, then it's not much of an offering. Not worth anything. It's not much at all. And so he refused, and the same account is in 1 Chronicles, that is chapter 24, I think, says the same thing. That's an interesting point there when it comes to giving an offering. You have to think about Cain and Abel. Abel brought of his flock of his sheep, and it would have been worth a lot, the sheep would have been. Why was Cain's despised? Was it because maybe it didn't have value in the same sense that it was, well, I don't need these, he was raising vegetables, I guess. We don't need these things. We'll keep the rest here and give this to God. Was that it? What? Yeah, yeah. And that, what is it? Is your sin lies at the door? I forgot there how it goes in verse 7 of chapter 4. Yes.
Also, when you farm, there's some good fruits and some damaged fruits.
Mm-hmm.
He might pick all the damaged ones and, I'm going to give the old ones and offer them.
We don't know exactly, but you kind of wonder. And this principle here, that the reason it comes to mind is because of what David, he points a principle out here in giving. He said, there's no way that I, because if you read the verses before, Ornan said, look, I'm not going to give you this mountain or this hill. I'm going to give you the oxen to sacrifice and all that. David said, no, I pay for that. I pay for that. Otherwise, what kind of an offering is that to give to God if it's something I got for free? If I'm going to give something to God, it's something I have to have expended money or value for, and not just something that is a freebie. And a good point there. Let me just quickly summarize, and we'll quit right here at just before 5 o'clock. We go into 1 Kings chapter 1. David is advanced in years. He's verse 1 and getting very old. One of his sons, who happens to be older than Solomon, in verse 5, his name is Adonijah. And he cooks up an affair here with Joab, the commander-in-chief, and with Abiathar, the high priest at Jerusalem, to have him down in the Kidron Valley anointed to become the king in place of David. David's still alive, but he can't get out of bed. Well, the other ones, Zadok, who's a high priest at Gibeah, Nathan the prophet, and his own wife Bathsheba, recognize we got a problem here. And so Nathan says to Bathsheba, go in to tell your husband the king what has happened. Because we all know, and David has expressed clearly, that Solomon is to be the king and to take his place. He has to be able to rise up enough to make it clear in front of witnesses that Solomon is the king. And so she does in verse 28, and actually after David then calls for her after word has gotten to him. So David told her, now listen, go tell these three men down in verse 32, Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and Benaniah the son of Jehoiada, these three who are faithful, that you go and you anoint Solomon as king. And in verse 34 and 35, that's exactly what they did. And so he became the king. Adonijah was, in his own right, a kind of a treacherous man. In some of the final days of David's life, in chapter 2 up to verse 12, he instructs Solomon in things that he needs to be aware of and do. Finally, people like Adonijah, his own brother, Abiathar was exiled, Joab was executed, Shimei is executed. And finally, but David here in verses 10, 11, 12 dies. So David rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. The period that David reigned over Israel was 40 years, 7 years. He reigned in Hebron and in Jerusalem 33 years. And Solomon sat on the throne of his father, and his kingdom was firmly established. A lot of bloodshed. This was a nation growing. It had not yet, and in fact, all through the period of the kings, you have a nation that has not really developed. You still have treachery, murder, killing going on, people trying to kill their own relatives so they could become king and that type of thing. And you see it in David's family here. And Adonijah was in some ways just like Absalom, looking for the opportunity. But that ends the survey of David's life, the man after God's own heart, twice in the Bible that is stated. You read the Psalms and you see how this man thought much of the time. God saw many things that you and I maybe would overlook. When you read 1 and 2 Samuel, you see his sins and mistakes, some of those type of things. But we need to try to look at it the way God does. And here's a man who wrote most of the 150 Psalms that we have in the Bible. And we draw on those for strength and help in times of trials and difficulties. And they do just that, just as they did for David when he wrote them and when he was alive and experiencing those things he was going through. But he is an interesting man, very interesting, and you see how the mercy that he would show to people, the rewards, how he would take care of people and do all of these things when he should have, when you would have thought that he would have executed those who committed some, he was very merciful, and he held way. Well, we'll stop there, and we'll be after the feast getting into some different subjects and going a different direction as far as what we will cover in the Bible studies at that time.